You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Today's episode is brought to you by Kronos. Kronos provides HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support, motivate, and engage them. They put HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping on a single cloud-based platform. Learn more about Kronos HR, payroll, talent, and time at kronos.com/HR swagger. That's kronos.com/HR swagger. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Every day, funeral director Caitlin Doty receives dozens of questions about death. Not surprisingly, the best questions come from kids. Because let's face it, children have zero filters, and they're not afraid to ask about the things that we adults secretly wonder about but are scared to bring up. Questions like, what would happen to an astronaut's body if it were pushed out of a space shuttle? Do people poop when they die? Can grandma have a Viking funeral? In her new book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death, Caitlin Doty blends her mortician's knowledge of the body and the intriguing history behind common misconceptions about corpses to offer factual, hilarious, and candid answers to 35 distinctive questions posed by her youngest fans. And today I'm happy to welcome Caitlin back to the podcast to answer a few of those questions, like, why don't we eat humans after they die? And what if they make a mistake and bury me in a coma? She reveals why it's illegal to own or sell human remains, but you might be able to own human bones, and discusses how strict laws intended to prevent necrophilia also put a real damper on how a corpse can be displayed and disposed of. But she says you can pretty much do whatever you want with your grandmother's ashes. Speaking of cremation, she explains how a whole person can fit into that tiny urn, what happens when a cemetery runs out of room, and unravels some famous movie myths about death. Plus, she takes me behind closed doors at a funeral director's convention, opens up about a mortician's worst nightmare, and why superglue may be a mortician's best friend. Coming up with Caitlin Doty in just a moment. I'm happy to welcome Caitlin Doty back to the podcast. Caitlin is a mortician and the author of the New York Times best-selling books From Here to Eternity and Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. She is the creator of the Ask a Mortician web series and founder of the Order of the Good Death. Now she answers your questions about death, dying, and what happens next in her new book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. Caitlin Doty, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Last time we spoke about your previous novel, From Here to Eternity, in which you explored the myriad of funerary traditions around the globe and compared them to our relatively limited options here in the U.S. I'm curious, before we get into the new book, has there been any progress on that front since then, or are we still slaves to the whole funeral industrial complex?
We're definitely slaves to the funeral industrial complex, yeah. But I do think it's getting better. Just a month or so ago, I talked about this in From Here to Eternity, the idea of human composting, the idea of introducing that as a disposition option. You could cremate, you could bury, or you could compost your dead. When I wrote about it just a couple of years ago, I thought there was no chance of legalization of that process for years and years and years. And wouldn't you know it is now legal in Washington State to compost your dead.
Is that the only state where that's being considered right now?
Only state that passed? it's currently passed and you know, it'll still be a year or so before it comes into being, but it's the only place that it's legal. But the fact that we were able to appeal to environmentalists and appeal to the idea of people being able to choose what they want done with your body. Because something like human composting, you tell some people that and they go, oh, what a horrific Soylent Green future. And then you tell other people and they go, wow, that's the first thing I've ever heard that makes me feel okay to die.
Yeah.
I'm a composter. Right. I'm a greenie. This is exactly what I want. So that's why you got to have options for
people. And it's the most natural thing, really. I mean, we've been composting ourselves after we die, or not composting ourselves, but have been decomposing
basically
and feeding nature for time in memoriam, I guess.
And the earth is already a fantastic decomposer. That's that's why we bury body just straight in the earth, so we can decompose in a natural burial. But the idea behind this composting is it goes faster and it can happen in an urban environment. You're not buying a piece of land to decompose. You can go to almost like a center, like you would be cremated at a crematory. You can be composted at this recompose facility. And it ends up with this nutrient-rich soil that you have completely – the human body transforms completely into soil.
I'm curious. What is it like for you when I'm assuming there are conferences and conventions for funeral directors and morticians, just like any other trade. How do other people in the industry, especially those who work for, quote unquote, big funeral, react to you when you're at something like that? Are you shunned? Are you embraced? Are you seen as an agitator?
I'm definitely seen as an agitator, but I spoke last year at the National Funeral Directors Association, and I'm speaking again this year at the National Funeral Directors Association. And if you had told me 3, 4, 5 years ago that they would ask me to come speak, I would have laughed you off the stage. Like, I would never have believed. So I really think that the people, I guess you could say, in power are waking up to the idea that my voice is not a flash in the pan, that my colleagues' voices who want greener death options, more low-income options, more family-centered options are not a flash in the pan, and they have to pay attention to us if they want to move forward into the future of death. And I'd say there's 3 categories of funeral professionals. There are those who are totally on my side and with me and doing the same kind of advocacy and work that I'm doing. There are people who are in the middle who don't totally get what I'm going for, but they could see how some of it would be really useful with their families, and they ask a lot of questions about how they can integrate some of these ideas. And then you have the real old school guys who just think that I am an attention-seeking starlet, fame-hungry agitator, you know, just demoness. Like, they just could not dislike me more. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, they say that means you're doing something right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say so. What is it like at the Funeral Directors Association conference? Does it get wild? Do people hook up? Like,
well, it's a lot of – I mean, I'm not going to the right parties, I think, that. But it's interesting
there
when
right
I'm there.
I
probably, yes. Yeah, some funeral directors go hard, I think. But when I go and when I walk the floor, the convention floor, which is just as surreal as you think it is, like, it's basically like a car trade show, except the cars are hearses and, you know, caskets and exactly what you'd think it would be on a big convention floor. And I'll have usually an older white man in a suit walk up to me, and I never know what that conversation is going to be. It's sort of this moment of tension where, is this guy going to say, I love what you do, I do the same thing in Oregon? Or is he going to go, you know, basically confront me for my anti-funeral industry views? Well, and you kind of, it's that moment of like, what is this man going to say to me?
What do you look for in a good casket? I'm just curious. I mean, apparently there are a million different options of caskets out there. So
there are. It depends on who you're talking to. What I look for in a good casket is very different than what someone in the more traditional industry would say is the best casket. Personally, my favorite thing is a simple, unbleached cotton shroud that decomposes quickly. The caskets that we sell at my funeral home are wicker and bamboo and seagrass and these decomposing, very quick to go back into the earth.
Okay, so
caskets.
They're not those big, heavy, mahogany, lots of chrome or brass.
We don't sell those, but funeral homes traditionally love them, and they love selling something called, it makes a fortune for them, and it's something called a sealer casket that they really like, which is paying extra money to have a seal, a rubber seal, gasketed seal around the edge of your casket. And the idea is it protects grandma from the ravages of underground and how it, but for me, the point is to decompose and to get to go back into the earth, as opposed to the fortress we put around most of our dead bodies in a typical American cemetery.
I assume that the gasket was required by law.
That's not true. Yeah, that's funeral directors would love you to believe that.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't want my whole thing to just be dumping on other funeral directors,
sure.
But here's what I say to them. The moment that a family can come into your establishment and not told that it is illegal to not embalm a body or illegal to not have this huge casket with a seal around it, both of which are completely fine if you want to bypass, completely legal to bypass. If the family doesn't know that and they're made to feel like it's a legal requirement for them to pay for all these things, then I can't stand behind you. You need to change that. You need to be honest with people about what they are empowered to do.
Mm-hmm. And in your opening of your latest book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs?, you reiterate your mission of not only taking on kind of big funeral and opening up people's options, but destigmatizing death and making it acceptable to talk about. What do you think is the biggest hurdle to quote unquote death acceptance? Why are we so weird about it?
We're so weird about it because the culture is just set up to have us fail in the conversation. So we really had a time, a period in the 1800s and prior to that in the United States where death had to be an open conversation. Mm-hmm. People were dying left and right. The family took care of their own dead. And now that we outsource most of our death, whether it's the dying outsourced to a nursing home or to a hospital or the dead body outsourced to a funeral home, we are able to put our tough transitional times in the hands of someone else that we pay. And on one hand, that's a fantastic service to take some of the burden off families. But on the other hand, we're missing out on these rituals and these powerful moments. And so if you're a child that's born into this world, into this environment, you may never see a dead body until you're in your 30s.
Right.
You may never encounter death as real other than the fact that people are dying overseas and being shot in mass shootings and, you know, all of these terrifying narratives about death, horror movies. Those are the zombies. Those are the only things you see. You never see what children got to see 100, 150 years ago, which is just grandpa in the parlor, mom in the parlor, a brother or sister, unfortunately, in the parlor. And I'm not arguing for return to higher infant mortality, to be clear. I don't want more death. But when someone does die, making it normal, making conversations about it normal. If grandpa died last year and your 8-year-old is saying, what's he doing underground? Instead of saying, he's sleeping under there in his casket bed in the clouds, you can talk about what happens to a dead body and how decomposition happens and why that's a natural, even interesting process and okay to be curious about.
Your book does a great job of answering these kind of questions and does feel like it's kind of a conversation starter on death. But it's just strange to me that literally this happens to every living creature on the earth. And yet we're so weird about it. You know, anyone who tells you they don't think about their own death is just a liar.
Yes.
But no one ever wants to vocalize it. It's so odd.
It is. And people always say, people treat my advocacy as a niche thing. It's this weird niche thing that this morbid girl does. It's like, what about this is niche?
Yeah.
This is the primary human existential experience that we're all facing. And the reason that it's interesting to answer questions from kids is that we all reach a point, probably about 7, 8, 9, where we realize that death is final and that everyone around us is going to die. And that's a harsh, cruel awakening that some people never really recover from in their lives.
Yeah.
And if we can be more open, the way we try to be more open about sexuality or about religion or about just open to having these hard conversations, death needs to be included in that.
So these are questions that children have asked you.
Yeah, they're children.
Right?
They're all, sourced from, I say, free-range organic children.
Yeah, who have no filter. And so
no
it's
filter.
Great. So in many cases, they're asking the questions that everyone thinks, but we don't want to be weird about it.
Exactly. And the title comes from a kid that I was in Australia, and he asked that question, when I die, will my cat eat my eyeballs? And immediately my brain just fired. I was like, that's such an amazing way to ask that question.
Yeah.
Is that we're all sort of like, when we adults talk about it, it's like, oh, what if I die alone and nobody finds me and will my cat eat me? And it's this terrifying thing. And here you have this kid asking it in a way that's really funny and accessible. And yeah, it's a hard topic. It's hard to think about dying alone and your cat eating your body.
Yeah.
But it's also okay to be curious about it. It's also okay to say, give me the nitty gritty. Let's talk about it. Let's actually know the answer to this.
I mean, in every encounter I have with a cat, I sit there and I wonder if they're going to scratch out and eat my eyeballs just when I'm alive.
I mean, and the answer is,
we don't get along well.
Spoiler, it will take a while, but eventually they will eat you. They share some 98.7% of their DNA with lions. You know, they are creatures, and big charismatic animals like bears, lions, tigers, they will eat dead animals. They'll eat carrion if they come across it. They're apex predators, but they're not above eating a pre-dead meal because it's available to them. And cats are the same way. They, of course, just want to eat their normal food like you've trained them to do. But if you're not responding and not feeding them for days and there's a food source right there, they'll go for your lips. They'll go for your eyelids. They'll go for the soft, accessible parts of you.
Okay.
That may
include your eyeballs. But the eyes might not be the first?
The eyes are definitely not the first.
Okay.
They're not like
they're
the crown jewel
lower
of the
meal. Food pyramid.
They're lower on the food pyramid, but they may get there.
Now, I want to go through some of my favorite questions from here. First one, can I keep my parents' skull after they die? People seriously ask that. What do they want to do with it? They want to make an ashtray or do a very, very realistic production of Hamlet?
Exactly. Mostly a realistic production of Hamlet, I think. This is one that I will say people don't usually ask it when they come into the funeral home with an actual death. It's more of a,
it's
something that
thing.
People are really theoretically interested in, probably more than like, I'm ready to sign the paperwork right now.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've discovered, and there aren't any super clear answers about this, but in talking to human remains experts and the various people that I spoke to, I just don't see any way that it can legally be done in the United States, because we have things called abuse of corpse laws, and each state has them, and they basically don't allow you to do something that one quote from Kentucky, I believe, is outrage ordinary family sensibilities. And my question is, what is that? What is an ordinary family sensibility?
Right.
You know, if dad wanted me to dress him up in a clown suit and prop him up in the corner, that doesn't outrage me, but it outrages my neighbor too much for it to be possible.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's I love that stuff. I love that kind of like, what is respectful mean to one culture versus another culture or even your neighbor?
Yeah.
You know, so but because of abuse of corpse laws, basically, when someone dies, you can cremate them, you can bury them, or you can donate them to science. And those are sort of only your three options. Now composting in Washington, now alkaline hydrolysis, which is water cremation in about 20 states. So, but defleshing the head, you know, cutting off the head, defleshing it, using dermestid beetles to eat all of the little flesh off of it and returning it to a family, that's just so far away from what a normal funeral home would be able to even close to offer you. I just have to say that it's not really possible.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of, I do a lot of dream crushing in the book.
Well, these abusive corpse laws come up a lot in this book, and they are kind of the thing that kills all the fun.
It seems. Really do. Yeah. And you know, there are really good reasons for them. Mm-hmm. Anti-necrophilia laws, important.
Yeah.
the idea of not exploiting bodies that don't want to be exploited, because we have a whole pretty dark history in this country and other Western countries of digging up bodies, stealing bodies, taking marginalized people's bodies and putting them on display or autopsying them or studying them without their consent. They're just stolen.
Wow.
And so the abuse of corpse laws are really put into place to prevent that sort of thing from happening to people who just want their body nicely buried.
Yeah.
But they also kind of ruin the fun on some of these other things.
And apparently there are laws also against owning or selling human remains, but there's a loophole because you say that technically there's no law forbidding the owning or selling of bones. So in theory, you could have a human skull.
This depends on who you talk to. There are a lot of experts who say, no, this absolutely is remains. Like, what are you talking about? But most of the skulls that, so if you've been to someone's house and they have a real human skull on their shelf, it probably did not come from their uncle. It probably came from India or China and these online bone traders who will take these skulls from people who couldn't afford a cremation or, you know, an overrun cemetery, overcrowded cemetery, and then sell them to people.
Okay. So there's
a
lot of ethical questions.
There's a lot of ethical gray area, murky area. Like, I personally, as much as I would love to have a memento mori skull on my shelf where I could just, you know, put my head in my on my hand and gaze at it and ponder my own mortality, I don't think that I would be able to personally own a skull.
I wonder about that loophole. Does it have something to do with medical skeletons, maybe?
There's definitely things with medical skeletons. And what I will say is that if you've seen a fully articulated skeleton somewhere, the experts I talk to argue that, yes, it's also pretty illegal for a university or a scientific donation company to deflesh all of this, but that people tend to look the other way when it comes to these because the assumption is that it's for a good medical study, scientific reason.
Okay, yeah, because how would they get those skeletons then?
Right, they've been allowed to do it, and they do continue to do it, but there's really no way to do it outside of that establishment.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Caitlin Doty when we come back in just a minute. There's a reason they made a movie about two men defying great odds to get some White Castle sliders. They're really that crave-worthy. And now you can make those same delicious sliders at home with White Castle's microwavable sliders. White Castle sliders from the grocery store have that same one-of-a-kind taste that White Castle has been serving in their restaurants for years. From their unique signature buns to their 100% beef patties, which are cooked on a bed of steamed grilled onions, these sliders come in a variety of flavors that are made to be enjoyed. Craving something spicy? The jalapeno cheese sliders are sure to give your day that tasty kick it needs. Or if you're hungry for something a little more traditional, their cheese sliders are the perfect choice. Folks, I've been hearing about how good White Castle burgers are for my entire life. And then a few years ago, I was in Chicago one night and asked my buddy who lives there to take me to a real White Castle's restaurant. Believe me, I didn't have to twist his arm. White Castle burgers were his favorite treat since childhood, and he said he just about lived on them when he was in college. That's the night I got hooked on White Castle's cheese sliders. I'm not embarrassed to say I probably ate about a dozen of them that night. There's just something so simple and satisfying about meat, cheese, and onions on those pillowy soft buns. It was a tough adjustment when I came back to California, and there weren't any White Castle restaurants to be found, and man, I searched. But now, White Castle has come to the rescue with sliders in my local grocery store. You know that White Castle burgers are iconic, and their fans like me aren't going to settle for anything less than an authentic White Castle experience. So I'm thrilled to say that their microwavable sliders really do live up to the name White Castle. Just 60 seconds in the microwave, and it takes me back to that night in Chicago so many years ago. From the castle or the grocery store, you can satisfy your craving anytime with White Castle. Go to whitecastle.com/kick. to get $1 off the purchase of any 4 or 6-pack White Castle sliders. If you found $100 on the street, would you pick it up or keep walking? Of course you'd take the money. So why do you keep picking winners and not betting on them? That's why you should check out MyBookie. It's fast, it's easy, and they pay when you win. Because where you're betting is just as important as who you're betting on. Do the smart thing. If you're going to bet this football season, bet with MyBookie. Did you know that you could bet on games after kickoff? If by the second half it looks like your bet's going to lose, you can always just take the other side. If you're the kind of person who likes to bet a little and win a lot, try a parlay. If all your picks come through, you'll multiply your winnings. And no matter how you bet, the NFL season is the best time of the year. Join now and MyBookie will double your first deposit. Use promo code KICKASS to activate the offer. That's promo code KICKASS. Visit mybookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. And get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential. And it's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Our listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Go to betterhelp.com/kick. Then simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/kick. And now, back to the podcast. Someone asks you, how does a whole corpse fit into a tiny box or an urn after it's been cremated? I've wondered that myself.
Well, we have the answer for you. And it's usually about, so when you look at a human, and you can have someone who is 6'5" and incredibly skinny, and someone who is 5 feet and weighs twice as much as the skinny person.
Right.
But the man who is 6'5", is his ashes are going to be a lot heavier than the woman who maybe had a lot of weight or excess fat on her, because fat is inorganic. Mm-hmm. It's organic material that burns away during the process. So all the organic material burns away in the incredibly high 1800 Fahrenheit degree temperature of the cremation chamber. And so in that incredibly high heat, all the organic material burns away, and what you're left with is inorganic bones. And so it's not really about how heavy a person is, it's how heavy their bones are.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means that my uncle, who was about 6'4", 6'5", is some of the heaviest ashes I've ever held or felt.
Really?
Because there was so much of him bones-wise. And that's really all that's left.
He was a really tall guy?
He was a really tall guy, really big guy. And that's all that was – the bones are what's left. And so we generally say that they're between, 4 to 8 pounds. And it just depends on how much bone was in the person, what is actually left after the cremation process.
I wonder, does the desecration of corpse law apply to ashes as well? Can you bake your grandpa's ashes into a cake or flush them down the toilet, do whatever you want, or what?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. And it also kind of depends on where you are and what you're doing. So in the United States, we have very lax laws when it comes to what you can or cannot do with ashes. Example, in Germany, a family is not allowed to have the ashes or even engage with the ashes really in any way.
Oh, really?
The ashes are treated as some sort of like thing that only a professional funeral director can.
Okay.
So you have to basically...
Well, admittedly, Germany has had some unpleasantness with cremation.
Right, yeah, a little bit of
the
history.
Past,
yeah, so, unfortunate history there. Yeah. So the funeral director has to take the urn with your ashes and take it directly to the cemetery, and they can bury it with you present, but at no time are you allowed to really interact with the ashes at the family. Forget scattering them or putting them into fireworks or whatever fun thing you want to do with them. Whereas in the United States, we actually have really, I would say, pretty open laws with ashes. You can take them home after. You can bury them if you want to, but you can also take the urn home, and it's really all bets are off after that.
Right.
It's not – they say there are laws like you cannot scatter on public. You can't go to Dodger Stadium and just dump him at home place, dump grandpa at home plate, even though if that's what he wanted. You can't go into a national forest and just dump them wherever you want. But as long as a private property owner gives you permission to scatter, you can pretty much scatter. Mm-hmm. And also, I say – there's no ash police. Like, no one's really coming for you with the scattering of ash. I mean, don't tell them that I told you that, but there's no one who's going to, there's no like a siren roars and pulls up behind you when you're scattering mom at a beach. Like, it's just not going to happen. So I think that it's a lot easier in the United States. And I'm pretty happy with our laws around ashes in the United States.
What about waterways? Is there any rule as to whether you can bury them at sea or bury them in a harbor or river? So, I mean, there are a lot of EPA regulations.
Exactly. General. And the thing about ashes, though, is that they're completely inorganic. They're not, you know, and that,
that's interesting.
That doesn't mean that, I mean, there's no DNA in there. Like, I couldn't, you couldn't test your dad's ashes and be like, oh, this is my dad.
That's fascinating.
Know, it's basically, yes, they're very, very important because they represent the person tangibly, but the traces of the person, and there may be things like metals based on where you lived or if you were a vegetarian or these kind of secret things that change the composition of the inorganic fragments. But for the most part, it's not you anymore. There's no DNA. So it's completely safe to have. There, I believe it was, I think this was at the Met or somewhere in New York. Someone scattered ashes in the pit. And they thought it was anthrax and they like evacuated the whole building. And no, they shouldn't have done that. But the ashes were completely safe.
Okay.
So there are with waterways, it's usually you're supposed to go out a certain amount of feet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're supposed to go out 500 feet, 2 miles, wherever it is that you live or whatever county you live. They'll have specific kind of boring rules as to how far you go out. But again, the Coast Guard isn't going to come screeching up with their sirens on and say you're not close enough.
I'm interested in what you said about the fact that there's no DNA in ashes, because I remember maybe, I don't know, a couple of years ago or something, there were some investigations into some shady pet funeral homes. People weren't getting their pets' ashes, so they did some kind of test that determined whether it was a dog or whether it was a cat or a gerbil or whatever. I assume that that was done through DNA. Do you remember that?
You know,
I don't know that
exact case, but I will say that it's one of the big reasons why if you're a man who's murdered your wife to get the life insurance, you want to have her cremated real
okay.
quick because it becomes incredibly hard to tell what, you know, if she buried, you can just dig her up and find out information years and years and years down the line. But if you cremate someone, it really knocks out that ability.
Now, the next question I have for you is, will a corpse sit up and moan? This is something that I've seen in the Indiana Jones movies, I think, and other stuff. It's not something supernatural, I don't think, but I don't know. In the movies, it's probably from buildup of gases or maybe muscle spasms, something like that. Does that really happen?
It happens, but it happens in a much smaller way than you think. So immediately after someone dies, your neurons are still firing. There are muscle twitches. Like there can absolutely be within an hour or 2 hours after someone dies, twitches of the body. And generally, medical professionals like nurses are familiar with this, and they're not going to go, oh, dear God, it's alive. You know, they're gonna understand what's happening. And as far as making noises, people ask me all the time, do you have anything paranormal that's happened?
That was going to be my next question.
You know,
anything weird happened late
know,
at night?
I know. And I hate to, I'm the absolute worst person to ask this because there are funeral directors who absolutely will say, this happened. This
really?
Was so spooky because I am not one of them because I'm just always looking for the biological reason that something happens. And you're exactly right. You mentioned it. When you have buildup of gases because of the bacteria eating away in your stomach and they're farting inside of you, basically, and it builds up and builds up and builds up, that can absolutely cause air to escape, whether through whatever hole it does escape from your body, and it makes a low moaning sound, or when you're moving a body around, it can almost seem like it's moaning. And yeah, that's really freaky, but you can also tell that person is definitely dead and that it was a biological thing that was happening within them.
Interesting.
So yeah, there can be noises, but and no body, I will say, is sitting directly up. That's a trope that happens all the time. They're not rising like Dracula straight out of the coffin. That's not happening. There can be these little micro movements, but I always say it's because you're dead. The body is dead, but it's still very much alive inside. There's all sorts of things happening inside your body biologically that do not involve the actual human lying in front of you.
Okay. So you've never seen anything weird that you couldn't explain?
I've never seen anything I couldn't explain. I mean, I've seen some things that I couldn't fully explain, but science, a good scientist in that area could explain it.
Now, this is another one that sort of falls into the movie category, I think. If I die making a stupid face, Will it be stuck like that forever? Which makes me think of the Ring movies where someone's scared to death and has a heart attack and they have this horrified grimace on their face, just frozen. Does that really happen?
Right, cut back and the person is in the exact same. You're like, oh, I see, right. I see in their eyes what they saw right before they died.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. No, I do talk about a very specific loophole that's really controversial in forensic circles that's about this moment of cadaveric spasm where something can almost... The death is so violent and so shocking that some part of you can freeze. And it's usually not your face. Huh. It's your hands curled up or something in you that curls up instinctually or physiologically within your body. But for the most part, when you die, all of the muscles in your face go incredibly loose. So the bigger problem with someone who's immediately died is that their mouth falls open, their eyes fall open, and they look incredibly dead. And so that's why before rigor mortis sets in, which is the stiffening of the muscles, we want to make sure that the mouth is closed and that the eyes are closed because it's hard to get them in that position after rigor mortis sets in a couple hours. But it does not happen that your face will freeze immediately at death and stay in that position.
And doesn't rigor mortis, I don't know if it passes, but sort of eases up and the feel or the texture of the body changes after a few days, right?
Exactly. It's called break. The timeline, and this depends on how humid it is, what latitude you're at, all of these different factors. But the body for about the first 3 hours or so is incredibly loose and pliable, and you can really put it in any position that you would like. Mm-hmm. And then for roughly the next 24 to 36 hours, it's in rigor mortis, which means it's incredibly stiff. It's actually the muscles. It's not the bones. It's the muscles that stiffen up and get very, very tight. And then it will break either by the funeral director manipulating the body to make sure and massaging it out to make sure that it breaks, or it just happens naturally after a certain amount of time.
Okay. Now, there's so many of these that I've wondered myself, so this is kind of fun for me.
Yeah, of course.
One of them is, what happens when a cemetery is full of bodies and can't add any more? I've thought that many times.
And people, I think that especially in the United States, it's talked about as a bigger issue than it really is. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I think that is because if you've ever flown over the middle of the country, that we have room as a big country to have more cemeteries. Mm-hmm. But the fact is people want to be buried near where they're from. Mm-hmm. So there are problems in Los Angeles and New York and Chicago and Seattle. Those are the big cities are the problems with overcrowded cemeteries.
Okay.
And cemeteries that frankly just a plot cost $10,000, cost $20,000, just too much for the average family. In Los Angeles, some of our fancy funeral cemetery establishments, we're talking $100,000 for a plot. It's pretty bonkers. So there's all sorts of things that are potentially to do, but something I've been fascinated about recently is the idea of grave recycling. And this is so interesting because it's what most other countries in the world do.
That's right. I remember that from your last book.
Is the idea that you only get a certain amount of time in your grave. You're leasing a grave. You're not owning a grave. It's like
not
renting an apartment.
In perpetuity.
Exactly. And it's not a perpetual burial, perpetual care of a cemetery. So when grandma goes in, so I was just in Brazil recently, and they have something called the necropole, which is 13 or 14 stories high. It looks like a resort hotel, but it's all crypts. It's all burial. And they only get 3 years in their crypt before they are then removed and the last little bits of flesh are taken off. And those bones are either cremated or they're put in an ossuary, which is a special place for bones. And then that spot is opened up and new people can go in. So I think it would really behoove the United States to think more critically about that and if that's something that we're willing to do.
Here's the thing that I've wondered about it, though. What happens financially when a cemetery fills up? Because tell me if I'm wrong here, but my perception is that most cemeteries are essentially a pyramid scheme, aren't they? I mean, they have to keep bringing in new, quote unquote, paying bodies in order to cover the cost of the maintenance and security, including all those old graves that aren't paying and they may be 100 years old.
I've never said it that way, but that's actually a pretty good way to put it. Exactly. And I think that there are a lot of, if you go to, say, New England and you just can't swing a cat without finding an old old-timey cemetery from the Revolution era or the Civil War era. There are just everywhere these old cemeteries, and a lot of them are in intense disrepair, or the headstones are crumbling or falling beneath. And that is potentially the future for a lot of our cemeteries because, you're paying for perpetual care. You're supposed to be paying for forever when you buy this plot. But if the whole thing fills up, where's that money really, you know, unless you've really thought it out and set it up right, or you can get more land next to it to continue to bring in more fresh money to keep everything going, it's going to be a problem. And they've had issues in Chicago and a couple different cities recently with just real neglect of older cemeteries.
Is it a situation where, I don't know, public entities like cities and counties are taking them over eventually? Because at a certain point, no one wants to pay for that.
Exactly. They do sometimes. But we also have a long history in the United States of people building targets over these types of cemeteries, or building freeways, or just bulldozing in and, and kind of ignoring the people who were buried there, especially if they weren't wealthy people or white people, or, you know, the kind of cemeteries that historical societies would come in and say, wait, no, no, no. Stop the bulldozer. Like, you know. So it is, but I also think that this is part of the conversation to have is, should the goal then be forever? You know, should the goal be we have to maintain this grave forever? And if it's important to you and your family, then the answer is yes. But if maybe you're willing to say, maybe I'll have a natural burial, and maybe it's okay if I decompose into the ground and my entire body is gone within a couple of years. You know, when I completely become part of the earth, and then you put a plaque with my name on it nearby, you know, is that just as valid as the idea of here's my headstone forever and ever?
Now, another form of renewable corpse disposal comes up in the book. Someone asks you, I don't know who asked you this, but we eat dead chicken. Why not dead people? I'm not opposed to that. I mean, in this day and age, it's cruelty-free meat, you know, it's environmentally conscious, and I mean, if we die in the wild, something's going to eat us, whether it's maggots or coyotes anyways. So
might as well be another human. I think that what they've discovered and what science has discovered is that beyond the general taboo, although there are many tribes historically that have or groups that have used mortuary cannibalism, which is the idea of eating your own dead.
Right.
And so it's not a, you know, we're going to steal the skull of another tribe. It's simply we consume our own dead for a myriad of reasons, like bringing them back into the fold, keeping them alive through this kind of cannibalism. When you really get into it, it makes a lot of sense while they're doing it. But the idea, the real science behind it, is that humans just don't provide a lot of good calories and a lot of good proteins that other animals do. So I think that at a certain time, evolutionarily, if humans had proven to be this incredibly delicious, like nutrient-rich, like bang-for-your-buck type of meat, then our history might be a little different. But they're just – they're really not. They're not that good. We're a lot of fat. Or a lot of like stringy, not very good meat. We don't have a ton of calories to us. So I think we're just not a great food source.
Okay. Another question in here is, what if they make a mistake and they bury me in a coma? Now, this is something that actually used to happen. They used to have the caskets with the bell attached to the gravestone in case you got buried. Does that still happen anymore?
It was a real Victorian preoccupation of the idea that we're going to be buried alive. And they would do these pretty intense tests, like sticking needles under your nails and in your heart and in your eyeballs, which, of course, if you actually weren't dead, waking up to have a needle through your heart might kill you anyway.
But would that even wake you up from a coma?
No, it wouldn't. So, I mean, I'm no doctor, but no. So I think that whenever you hear now about somebody waking up in a morgue, first of all, it's incredibly rare, but it's a huge deal when it happens because we're so preoccupied with it, and even in our cultural imagination. But it tends to be a much less developed country where the person was, you know, it's always like, spoiler, that person was never dead to begin with. No one's waking up from the dead. They were just in a coma, or they were breathing so shallowly, or their pulse was so low, and the people who declared them dead were not great at their jobs, or were just, you know, a family member and thought they were dead and they weren't really dead. But that just doesn't really happen in our modern medicalized system.
Okay.
You know, we're not. And also, for example, in California, I have a certain amount of time that I have to wait to get all these permits before I can bury or cremate someone. So and most people who are buried tend to be embalmed. So if you weren't dead before the embalming, you will certainly be dead after the chemical procedure that drains all the blood from your body and replaces it with formaldehyde.
Yeah.
So the idea of being trapped in a big casket that you can't get out of is just not it's terrible. I'm claustrophobic. That freaks me out, but it's just not going to happen.
Another person asks you, why was my grandmother's body wrapped in cellophane under her clothes? This one gets to what I think is the bane of every mortician's existence, right? Leakage.
Leakage, yeah. It's sort of like Mufasa, like, ah, all morticians. It's the idea. There's many reasons that a body would leak. First of all, wounds after you die do not heal.
Okay.
So once it's over, there's no more healing, regenerating of the skin, no more regenerating of healing a wound after someone dies. So if they had bed sores or they had some wound on
not
them as they're
dying.
Not just
stab wounds or something
Not just stab
like
wounds.
Okay.
No, I mean, older people, especially in nursing homes or incredibly medically fragile people, tend to have wounds that are being treated, but again, they're not going to heal. There's something called edema, which is the buildup of fluid in the body that will literally leak out really through the skin. And what you don't want as a funeral director is to lay grandma out for her viewing and there's 200 people coming in from prominent parts of the community to see her body. And there she is just leaking fluid over her nice blouse. So there are all of these tricks that morticians use to keep her contained in that way if she has a more difficult situation. So one of them is basically a sort of coverall onesie, like almost like one of those onesies that you see in like Ebola dramas.
You know,
that fully covers their body from head to toe.
Yeah.
And then another thing is saran wrap, kind of the old fashioned option is just to, if you have a big wound on your arm or you had IVs in your arm and this is leaking, just wrap it up with saran wrap and that will contain that leaking long enough to view the body.
Is there some material that's a mortician's best friend when you're trying to prepare a body?
There's a lot. I mean, I would say the most basic one is something like super glue or some sort of glue because the lips dehydrate and then the lips will kind of pull apart. So you gotta glue them together. The eyes might open, slide open a little bit, and you have to make sure they're slammed down for the viewing. It's really, I mean, bodies are fairly unruly. They're unruly in life and they're unruly in death.
Well, real quickly before we go, I'm curious, have you given much thought to what happens when you die, whether or not there's an afterlife? Is that something that you think about much?
I think about it. I personally have really come to the conclusion that I don't go anywhere, that I go into the void. And the idea of the void really haunts a lot of people, the idea of floating around and nothing blackness. But this is an oldie but goodie, understanding that you weren't conscious before you were born.
Right.
And I think it's that same sort of shutting down of the brain and consciousness when you die. And for me, that seems relaxing. I try the meditation apps. I can't get my brain to slow down. It would be great if I could just go into a void where I need not fret about that parking ticket I didn't pay or whatever it is. And that is a sort of heaven to me.
Well, again, the book is called Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. Caitlin Doty, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me back.
Thanks again to Caitlin Doty for coming back on the podcast. Order her book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Follow her on Twitter at TheGoodDeath. Subscribe to her YouTube series, Ask a Mortician. And learn more at CaitlinDoty.com or OrderOfTheGoodDeath.com. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Our listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Got a case of the post-podcast munchies? Well, White Castle sliders from the grocery store are perfect for conquering those craves. Made with 100% beef patties on a bed of steamed grilled onions, it takes just a few minutes to make your very own mouth-watering, one-of-a-kind tasting White Castle sliders. So get crave conquering and go to whitecastle.com/kick to get $1 off your purchase of any 4 or 6-pack White Castle sliders. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.